This is a special presentation from Civic Media. Civic Media is proud to be a part of the Cap Times Idea Fest in Madison. Tonight's broadcast is a live one-on-one discussion with Nancy Pelosi, the first female speaker of the House. We'll hear what she thinks about the state of politics and the presidential election. Now, live to the Cap Times Idea Fest in Madison.
Of a plan. That brainstorming was many months before release of the speaker's great new book titled The Art of Power, My Story as America's First Woman Speaker of the House. And long before the summer of intense notoriety for her role about the ascent of Vice President Kamala Harris to the presidential nomination. I was able to interview Speaker Pelosi for my column last month, and we talked about many things, including her relationships through time with some of Wisconsin's most famous political names. We're lucky to have as moderator tonight an award-winning national political journalist who has known the Speaker for decades. Karen Tumulty is a Washington Post associate editor and a columnist who writes about national politics for the Washington Post, and importantly, has grandchildren in Madison, so that's a... Just gonna go off my notes here a second and thank David Marinus, who seems to have brought half of the Washington Post newsroom to Madison. Thank you, David. The former editor Marty Baron in the first year, I'll never forget that. Karen has degrees from the University of Texas at Austin and the Harvard Business School, Texas grad. Before joining the Post in 2010, she worked for the Time Magazine and before that for the Los Angeles Times, and it's an honor to have her here tonight. I want to take a minute to sincerely thank our sponsors and partners without whom this pretty cool week, I think, wouldn't be possible. Epic Systems, Exact Sciences, HealthX Ventures, UW Health, the Carbone Cancer Center, Madison Gas and Electric, the Ascendium Education Group, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Co-sponsors include the University Research Park, the Century House, Overture Center for the Arts, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Madison Community Foundation, Cargo Coffee, the La Follette School of Public Affairs, Madison College, Leopold's Book Bar Cafe, and the Forward Theater Company. Thank you. We really do very much appreciate them. Our partners include Hinckley Productions, Civic Media, which is broadcasting this event tonight on the stations across the state. I believe there are 20 stations across the state, the Wisconsin State Journal, and Madison.com. One more note, which is repeated from my earlier session, so forgive me. Our host, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is committed to freedom of speech and freedom of expression as an essential part of their education mission. It is our expectation that you allow the speaker's presentation to occur without disruption. Any disruptions to the event will be handled swiftly by security. So, with that, I'd like to hand it over to the aforementioned Ben Wickler to take the introduction from here. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Madison. Could we give another round of applause to Paul Fanlon and to the whole team here at Idea Fest at the Capital Times here in Shannon Hall? What a gift to our community this institution is. I'm profoundly humbled and honored to be able to introduce tonight's guest of honor, and especially to do it in this setting, in this venue. I grew up coming to talks here as a kid, growing up in Madison. I had a dream opportunity to serve on the Capital Times student editorial board when I was 12, which I didn't know that not every newspaper has a student editorial board, but the Capital Times did. This is a place where getting involved in politics and public life makes people more idealistic, not less. And that's different from a lot of politics in a lot of places. But what I want to speak to tonight in introducing our guest is the fact that Speaker Emerita Pelosi, twice Speaker Pelosi, path-breaking, world-changing Speaker Pelosi, is a leader who makes the people around her more idealistic, to believe in the power of democracy, to make people believe in their own capacity to create change, at the same time as she wields the art of power at a level that our country has never seen. She grew up seeing what this was like. Her father was the mayor of Baltimore and a former congressman. She moved to California. She had five children. She served as the state party chair in California. And then when her children had grown, she ran for Congress and then ran for leadership, became the speaker in 2007, became the speaker again in the Democratic leader in 2017 and the speaker again in 2019. And it's step after step after step has faced some of the most frightening and impossible crucibles in American politics, faced a Republican Party that was bent on destroying our democracy and undermining the fundamental idea of America at so many steps, and a Democratic Party that, I can say, not always the easiest to deal with. And I, like so many of us, saw from afar her amazing work, and then I got to move to Washington, D.C. My wife worked in the United States Senate. We had a close friend who was working for Speaker Pelosi in the House, and I remember asking her once, how is it that she never loses a vote? How is it that she's able to figure out a way to pass all the bills through, to count the bills so perfectly, to bring people around who are thinking in so many different directions? And our friend, who was watching her in awe, often in close quarters in professional settings, said, the thing about Speaker Pelosi is that she calls people to act on their values. She said she connects, she understands people, she knows what's happening in their lives. I came to have the enormous luck of getting to work with her directly, and she would ask first about how my kids are doing. She asked the same thing when I saw her tonight. She would ask to see baby pictures. And then she would know people's why. She always tells people, know your why. Know why you're doing this. Because if you know your fundamental, to your core, the values that are propelling you to do this work, then you can withstand the heat and the attacks and the pressure and the lies, because you can stand firm on the ground of your values. And her genius, the genius of her leadership, is identifying the values that make people ready to go through anything to make the change that has to happen. We might not be a democracy today in the United States if it wasn't for Speaker Pelosi. We know to a certainty that tens of millions of people would not have health care today if it wasn't for Speaker Pelosi. We very well could not have ended two very long wars if it weren't for Speaker Pelosi's leadership. I was very involved in the fight against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And while people talk about John McCain and that moment he put his thumb down, the only reason we got to that point is because somehow, from the minority in the House, Speaker Pelosi gummed up the works and stopped the Republicans from repealing the Affordable Care Act on day one. They failed vote after vote, pulled votes off the floor, because she united Democrats and the country and divided the opposition based on the fundamental value that every person deserves dignity and respect and health care in the United States of America. She exercised that leadership. Now, you read and you see what she does on the national stage, in national press, in the halls of Congress and the White House. What I didn't realize until I got to see it firsthand is that part of the magic of what she does is she engages the grassroots. She believes in organizing down to her core. She, when I was at MoveOn.org working against the repeal of the ACA, I got to join conference calls that she would have every week with grassroots organizations across the country. And I don't know how she fit this in while leading Democrats in the House of Representatives and out negotiating the Republicans and Donald Trump. She would often be eating ice cream during the calls, which is a very Wisconsin approach to conference calls that we strongly approve of here in the Dairy State. And she would ask everyone to share what they were doing, and she would appreciate them, and she would tell them how much it mattered. She would say, like a mantra, you might hear it tonight, you have to own the ground. You have to own the ground. You have to organize at the grassroots level to bring the pressure up from below. That's an idea that is grounded in a respect for democracy and an understanding the art of power in a democracy, that it all ultimately comes from people. I decided in 2018 to move home to Madison, and I told Speaker Pelosi about it and said, it's the best place in the world to raise your kids. And I had three kids, and my wife and I, we moved back across the country, and I left, you know, Washington, D.C. I was involved in all these policy fights. Speaker Pelosi never left our side here. At every step in the long fight that we have had against the forces of authoritarianism in our state, she's been raising money, she's been spreading the word, she's been joining conference calls with Democratic Party of Wisconsin organizers to fire up volunteers, to call on all of us to own the ground. And this year, when everyone in this room has a superpower in the form of your ballot, and your time, and your dollars, and your work to ensure that democracy survives, Speaker Pelosi, as she is in every battleground state and every battleground House district across the country, she is with us here in our fight, because she knows that our work is grounded in the same values that she has exemplified and called upon everyone else to exemplify throughout her career. She calls on us to live up to the idea of democracy, to be a country where everyone matters. And that is a gift to us that we have to use. So let's give a gigantic round of applause to Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Madison, you seem to have a few fans here. So I do want to congratulate you on the book, which came out 5 weeks ago. It made it to number one on the New York Times list the first week, and it's been living in that neighborhood ever since. And if you have had even a minute to turn on a television here, you will know that you are in a swing state. And we are today 50 days away from that election. And here in Wisconsin, the ballots go out starting on Thursday. So how are you feeling about this election, Madam Speaker?
Well, first, thank you, Karen. What an honor it is for me to be here with each and every one of you. It's such a treat for me to be interviewed, moderated by, that's probably the moderation voice of Karen Tumulty. She is, in her own right, the star worthy of any audience to hear her views on any subject. I feel very honored. But then I found out that she has grandchildren in Madison. So, Karen's coming. How wonderful. Then I know the great magnet of grandchildren. Thank you, Karen. I'm honored that we're participating together here. And again, to be in this historic location, I want to make sure I have all of this right. Shannon Hall, Memorial Union of the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Capital Times Idea Fest. Hopefully we'll have some ideas to fest. Thank you, Paul Fanland, for your leadership, and David Swiffle. He said I could say Swiffle or Swiffle, for his starting all of this some decades ago. I do want to say what a special honor it is for me that Mayor Doyle and his wife Jessica are here this evening, because they... Where are you? Stand up. I was here earlier with Peter Bark, whom I'm hoping will help us win the House, but we're not talking about it, Peter. Here's this lady, Kathy. As the evening goes on, we'll acknowledge others who are with us. But first, I want to, again, thank you all for being here to hear Karen's question. Did I notice that this was a swing state? Came in, turned on the TV, one commercial after another, if you don't need any other indication. But Wisconsin is a great state. You have sent great representation to the Congress of the United States. Speaking from my own side of the aisle, we're just so proud, so very, very proud of your senator. She's just remarkable. You know it's what I'm talking about. Started in the House, moved on to the Senate, and we're Mark Pecan's district. We have in Milwaukee, we have, the most remarkable congresswoman. She's just wonderful. But anyway, you know all of these people. No need to me to say that, but it's really important for the country to make a decision in a few weeks, 8 weeks. And Wisconsin is the heartland of America. And I want all of you to know your power in all of this. I think you do. And to know your responsibility in all of this. What we're trying to do is to have a campaign that brings people together. We cannot become that which we are fighting. We have to try to bring people together. I have this pin, it's a flag pin, and on it says, one country, one destiny. One country, one destiny. And those are the words that were embroidered in Abraham Lincoln's coat the night that he passed away, he had on that coat. But that was his vision, and that's what he did, bringing our country together by winning the Civil War. We have a challenge now because of the divisions in our country. But I'm here in Wisconsin because of your importance. Not that it isn't pleasant to come here, and I've been here many times. But at this time in particular, you will see so much focus, so much listening to you, learning from you about the vision you see for our country. Now, I don't know in this historic hall if we're able to talk politics, so I won't go there unless the question directs me there. However, know your power. Just win, baby.
just win, baby. Well, so how confident are you that come election night, the Democrats are going to have a good night, both for the White House and the House and the Senate?
Oh, we can talk politics. I was being civic-minded with flag, link, and all. Here's the thing, and I say this with confidence and from firsthand experience. For the good of our country, it is absolutely essential that Hakeem Jeffries has the gavel on January 6th. The day that Congress votes to certify the election, to accept the results of the Electoral College. I say firsthand because I had the gavel on January 6th, but more important than that, we had the votes in the House to overcome the massive vote against from the Republican side of accepting those. So in terms of that night, let's hope that we will know that night. That's why I say, let's win, but I always say, let's win big, baby, so that it's conclusive. But whatever it is, the result is one that we, as those who honor and uphold the Constitution of the United States, respect the results of the election of the American people. We wish that everyone would share that view and that commitment to the Constitution. I think, talking about, I take nothing for granted in politics. This is a very close race. I think Kamala Harris will win overwhelmingly Kamala Harris and Tim Walz will win the popular vote in the country. But that doesn't elect a president. our founders had a different idea about how that would work, and we honor that Constitution. So we have to, until we can change that, we have to make sure that she does what they do win, because so much is at stake. This isn't an election that we would have against George W. Bush or Mitt Romney or Bob Dole, John McCain. We have an election, we have an outcome, we go to work, we try to find compromise, and we work for the good of the people. This is a different election. This is an election where not only the differences of opinion are on the ballot, and that's legitimate. That's a democracy. You have differences of opinion. You fight it out as to the role of government and where you are on the spectrum from right to left. That's who we are. But when there's a question of the integrity of our elections, when there's a question of the sanctity of the ballot, when there's a question of the democracy in our country, that puts the election at a higher stake, one that we must win, and win in a way that is unifying, respectful of all views. Whoever wins is president and vice president of the United States, not of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but also that recognizes differences, the beauty of differences of opinion in our country. And I would hope that at some point there are those who will take back the Republican Party. It's a grand old party. It's done great things for America, provided great leadership to our country. It has been hijacked, in my view, and by, I won't go into that unless you ask me, but but there is a great deal at stake. So let us try to, again, honoring the vision of our founders of this great country, the sacrifice of our men and women in uniform who fight for our freedom again and again and again, and democracy elsewhere, and importantly, the aspirations of our children. We have to go forward in a way that preserves our democracy, supports and defends our Constitution. Again, we must win the election.
You know, you just look at the events of the past week, and there's really not a lot to look at and find optimism that politics could ever return to something that even resembles normal. I mean, we've had the Republican nominee and the Republican vice presidential nominee slandering legal Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio. Yesterday, we had a second assassination attempt on former President Trump. I mean, when you look at these events, when you hear sort of the no holds barred rhetoric, where do you find hope?
Well, I find hope in the American people because I believe in the goodness of the American people. People say to me, where is hope? I say, hope is where it always has been, sitting right there between faith and charity. We believe in the greatness of our country. We believe in the goodness, the charity, and love of people, and therefore we have hope. And that is, but the goodness of the American people is, and the young people in our country and their aspirations for something better and their willingness to act upon that gives me hope. But I also have hope is owning the ground in a grassroots election and getting out your vote. And I also have hope in a message that is unifying to America, not divisive or threatening, but progressive, bold, unifying. Now, people say to me, well, it's not bold enough or something. I said, you know what? What works in Wisconsin works in San Francisco. What works in San Francisco may not work in Wisconsin. And we must win Wisconsin. We will win San Francisco. So, no, but it's, we have to have our common ground. We don't pull our punch. We don't lessen our commitment. But we find our common ground. And I say in my caucus, our diversity is our strength, but our unity is our power. And the power of our country is in agreeing to disagree, but in a way that is not dividing our country. We've been taken down a terrible path by a certain person who for a short time occupied the White House, never to go there again. I'm serious about that. It can never happen again.
Well, I would like to talk to you a little bit about your book, The Art of Power, although as I was reading it, I was thinking it could just as easily have been named The Skill of Power or The Talent of Power. And it's not meant to be a memoir. You kind of hint at the end that that book may come someday, and I certainly hope it does. But what people know about your story, you were the daughter of a congressman who became the mayor of Baltimore, five older brothers, baby of the family. But people might hear that and assume that you always had figured you were going to grow up to be Nancy Pelosi, that you know, that this always felt like this was your destiny. And I know we've talked about this before. As the baby and the only girl in the family, were those the expectations that you felt as a child?
No. No, I didn't feel that at all. I was a 50s teenager, rock around the clock, Elvis Presley, come on, forget politics, what was that? We were, thank you for going back to my family history, which I'm just, is always such a source of strength to me. I was raised in the, Peter, you'll appreciate this, Peter Barca, we share our Italian-American heritage, grew up in the Italian-American section of Baltimore, in Little Italy in Baltimore, Maryland, and in our family, we were devoutly Catholic, proud of our Italian-American heritage, fiercely patriotic, and staunchly democratic. Now, that I say that separately because some of the other things we shared with many other families. But in those days, being Democratic and Republican wasn't what it has turned into like right now. It was, you respected people for their interest in public service, whatever side of the aisle they were on. But no, I had absolutely no interest whatsoever. In fact, I was a very shy person. I still am. But, and that's why I love to see some of these candidates go out there and just be so in the spotlight. And I think that's great. Now, so here's the thing. I was able to go away to college, Girls Catholic College, 30, 45 minutes from home. That was the extent of my freedom. That was beautiful, and I loved it. Trinity College, all women's Catholic college. Okay, Trinity College. And then I married Paul, and I had five children in 6 years and 7 days, as I remind my... as I remind my archbishop, who excommunicated me, but anyway... That's his problem. But in Washington, the cardinal said communion will not be withheld from anyone because of whatever thoughts they have about a woman's right to choose. Anyway, so when you have five children, so that short period of time, you don't have time for anything. I mean, you don't even have time to wash your face. This is it. So when they're in school all day, which eventually comes. I always just say I had the best life and some of the worst days because you just never finished working. But nonetheless, when they were in school all day, then I started to volunteer in the Democratic Party. Then soon I became the chair of the party. But I never intended to run myself. I loved working behind the scenes for candidates and the causes. Something like what Ben Whitler does. Isn't he just the best? Isn't he the best? I'm such an admirer of his, and as you should, I know you all are, I heard your reaction to him, but you should know he's received that way all over the country on the infrequent occasions when he leaves Wisconsin. And he said to me one day in Washington, I'm going home to Wisconsin because I think it's the best place to raise a family. And here he is. Here he is. I don't know where he is, but here he is, somebody. In any event, but what bothered me was that my why, I'm a mom of five, and one in five children in America goes to sleep hungry each night, lives in poverty, goes to sleep. So that was my mission, to be engaged in politics, to prepare candidates, do the grassroots work, all the rest of that. So in any case, that's what I did. Then they came to me and said, you love the issues, you love the policy, you should run for Congress. Our congresswoman wanted to retire, and she said, I would feel so much better if you would run. But I had never, I'm telling to each one of you, never had one thought of running for Congress or anything. It just wasn't who I was. I was shy. So anyway, that was then, but anyway. So anyway, I go to my daughter, Alexandra. Some of you have heard this story because I tell it. It's the answer to this question. We had four of them in college and one going into senior year in high school. And she was 16. She was young, going into senior year. So, Alexandra, mommy has been asked to run for Congress. I've never even given it a thought to do such a thing, but people are asking me to run, and Sala Burton, who is the congresswoman, really wants me to think about it, and I said I'd have to ask you. Now, here's what it is. I don't know if I'll even win, but if I run, and if I were to win, I'd be gone 3 nights a week, Monday through Thursday, something like that. And but if any answer is good. If you want me to stay, I'm happy to stay, but otherwise I'd be gone 3 nights a week. Mother, now mind you, I ask mommy, mother, get a life. No, I'd never heard that expression. This is over 35 years ago. I'd never heard that expression. Get a life. What teenage girl doesn't want her mother out of the house 3 nights a week? So I went housewife, house member, house speaker.
Except when you get to the house, there aren't a lot of women there, and there is a sort of real pecking order among the men who are running the place. And at that point, the Democrats, starting in the mid-90s, were kind of wandering in the wilderness and couldn't win back a majority. How open were the men who were running the place to your ideas for doing things differently?
Well, when I went to Congress, there were 23 women out of 435 people. 35 women. I mean, 23 women, 11 Republicans and 12 Democrats. Immediately, being the former chair, I was like, this has to change. We have to make this different. We now have 94 Democratic women. They have like 30-something. We still all need more. But nonetheless, at the same time, our caucus is 70% women, people of color, LGBTQ. And that's a fabulous thing. Anyway, going back to then, I loved my committee assignments, appropriations, intelligence, all of that. And people came to me and said, you should run for leadership. I said, oh, no, I'm not running for leadership. No, you should run for leadership. We have to change something. This has to. I said, I'm not running for leadership. So I didn't. And then we lost in 94 and 96 and 98. And then it was like, I'm tired of losing. I know how to win elections. So I decided that I would run for whip, which was the position had been become open because David Bonner, who was the whip, was then leaving to run for governor of Michigan. So I said I would run. So the men, see, I always thought we would have a woman president long before we'd ever have a woman in leadership in the Congress, because you're not talking glass ceiling here. We're talking serious marble ceiling. This is not. And so when I was running, they basically said, you know, we have a pecking order here. These men have been waiting a long time for a position to open up, and this one and that one and that and that. And that. So that's the way it is. There's a pecking order. I said, you know, and there's an election, and we've been waiting over 200 years, and and so what? So much for your pecking order. Then they would say things like, and these are people I love. I mean, they're just really nice, but, you know. So they just didn't know. You know. So then they said, probably one of my personal favorites, who said she could run? Poor babies. As if I were waiting for their permission, all right? Okay. And so then they said, oh, this is further babyhood. Then they said, okay, why don't you all just write down on a piece of paper some of the things that the women in Congress would like to see done that hasn't been done, and then we'll do them for you. This was in this century. It was not that long ago. So, well, we went from being, oh, interesting, when there were 23, to when our numbers grew, oh, it was challenging, but then they were going to hold the line. But they were all lovely. They're my friends. I respect them. But it's just, it was just interesting. So then I said, I don't want you, and I think this holds for this election too, I don't want you voting for me because I'm a woman, and I don't want you voting against me because I'm a woman. I want you to listen to what I have to say about policy and politics and what we can do for the people, and then I won. We won the Congress and I got the gavel. After the gavel, it's a different world.
A couple of weeks before you left the speakership, you had some reporters in for lunch. You had us in for lunch in it's a very famous room in the Capitol that used to be Sam Rayburn's, what they called the Board of Education. And Speaker Pelosi told us something that you could just hear all of our jaws drop. You told us that the first time you ever set foot in a Democratic speaker's office was when you were the Democratic speaker. Yeah. So that sort of tells you how closed the system really was. For
imagine
women.
That. Never been in there. And I had been in the Republican Speaker's office because I was the Democratic leader, so I would go to negotiate to his office, but never to the Democratic Speaker's office. But they kept things in close, so, you know, but in any event, they were all reasonably fine after that. Yeah.
This book, you go through a number of key moments that sort of marked your tenure as Democratic leader, but there's one in particular I want to ask you about, because I was in the chamber that day, and that was this was like the most amazing high wire act of legislating I think any of us had ever seen, which was getting the Affordable Care Act through the House. And just so you can understand the degree of difficulty, the Senate, which had been kind of dragging their feet all along anyway, had lost, with the death of Senator Ted Kennedy, their 60th vote that made their bill filibuster-proof. So the Speaker had to pass the exact same bill that the Senate had passed, even though a lot of her members didn't like it. Some of her members knew that that vote was going to potentially end their career. I'm thinking, for instance, of Tom Perriello, who you talk about in the book. And in what I now find a chilling omen of what happened on January 6th, the Capitol was surrounded by thousands and thousands of protesters.
The day of Affordable Care Act, we're talking now. Yeah.
Yes, yes. As it's coming to the House vote, and she is having to pick these votes up one by one by one. And things outside the Capitol are so bad that, well, maybe you should talk about what happened to John Lewis as he was just, well, as John Lewis was walking to the chamber that day through all these screaming protesters, people were spitting on him. And he told Speaker Pelosi it was the worst thing he had seen since the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. It was the most anger and the worst treatment. So that is the environment that you are trying to get this done.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that when Senator Kennedy passed away and we lost the 60 votes, the press said to me, you're dead. Words to that effect, it's over for you. I said, no, this is an opportunity, a challenge of a generation. For 100 years, presidents have tried, Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Truman, and all have been trying until we had Medicare with Lyndon Johnson. That was one of the first breakthroughs. And when he signed it in Independence, Missouri, so President Truman, who had worked so hard on that but didn't achieve it, could be there for this. So anyway, we had a generational challenge. So I said, we're not going to let anything stand in our way. If there's a barrier to this, we'll break through the grate, push open the gate. If that doesn't work, we'll climb the wall. If that doesn't work, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll helicopter in. But we're not letting anything stand in the way of passing this bill. And so, and I want to say, Ron Kind was very, I'm just mentioning one from Michigan who at the time was on the Ways and Means Committee because, and what was, we didn't like this, let me say it another way, we did not like the Senate bill. That it was ridiculous in my view, but nonetheless, it was the best that they could do. So, but President Obama stuck with us on it, and we were able, read the book and you'll see it in the book. It's no use going into it, but the challenge between the House and the Senate, quite frankly, if Senator Kennedy had not passed away, I'm not even sure we would have had all 60 of those votes, but we did get them for our amendments to our bill. But again, it's too complicated. Unless we spent the whole night on that, it's easier just to read it in the book if you're interested. But it was remarkable. It was remarkable. And it took, this is what, and those, so after it was over, those guys, the press, they said, and some were women, but mostly it was the guys who were challenging your dad. They said, which one did you do? The gate. I said, we just pushed open the gate. Because you know why? We had the courage of the members that we needed those votes. But we also had the outside mobilization. Without the outside mobilization, without the groups with for one diagnosis or another, with people who are healthcare providers, all the rest saying, we have to have this change. We must make it accessible, affordable, and quality. We must have do away with the pre-existing condition barrier. We must not be have being a woman being a pre-existing medical condition. Women were paying 50% more. We can't have a situation where we have a limit on what insurance companies pay, whether it's annual or lifetime. And the pre-existing condition and the lifetime and, or annual limits were the biggest, shall we say, threshold to cross because we had, well, we had insurance industry, you know, had all of the, shall we say, vested interest fighting against us. But it was really a fight. And when John Lewis, you see, John and I carried the gavel over to use it to bring it. So we're a few of us there walking together and then the whole caucus behind us. And when we were parading over from the Cannon Building to the Capitol, which is not from here to the back of the room, they were screaming and yelling and spitting on John Lewis. You have to understand, John Lewis was a guiding light, our North Star, most beautiful. I served with him for over 30 years in the Congress. He was my dear friend. In fact, for his funeral, right before he died, I brought him this pin, and he wanted to have it. And then we had him lie in state on the same platform that was built for Lincoln to lie in state. So that's how we revered him. And these people were spitting on him. So you can just imagine. One of them was dressed up like a nun, too. But the nun, but the nuns saved us. The nuns were, forget the bishop. The nuns nun saved us. But it was hard. And then when we lost the, and I even said, if Hillary wins, I don't have to stay because she will protect the Affordable Care Act. This was such an important kitchen table issue for people, the cost of health care and the rest. And she, but then he came, and I said to him, I said, Mr. President, I will say to you what I've said to other presidents. I will never ask you to do anything that is not in your interest. And I think it would be in your interest for us to talk about how we can advance the Affordable Care Act. He didn't have the faintest interest. They tried maybe scores of times to repeal it. He said he was going to repeal and replace. I don't know what he was going to replace with because I don't even know what it was. But nonetheless, scores of times, and then we had to fight them again. 10,000 events around the country of people coming to tell their stories. I'm not talking about the provisions of the bill, their stories. My child was born, my baby was born, needed heart operation, right? What would have cost $1 million this, you know, those kinds of stories. And other stories about especially pre-existing conditions or cancer diagnoses. So in any event, John McCain saved the day. You know, this was the thumbs down heard round the world on that. So now, what's his name is saying, forgive me, I know we're in a sacred place, Obamacare sucks. That's what he says. And now he's saying he was only there to save it.
Yeah, the exact quote from last week's debate from President Trump when he was asked about the Affordable Care Act, which is pretty popular these days, was that he was going to, quote, save it and make it as good as it can be. So were you as startled as I was to hear that?
One thing you have to know about him is, forgetting that statement because he's not on a level, so let's not even think of that. But, and see, it's hard for me because I want to bring us together and all that. This is, so, and he says Obamacare sucks. No, we said, no, it doesn't suck, it cures. And that's what this is about. But he definitely wanted to get rid of it. Because that's where the money was. Health insurance industry, anti-government, shall we say, exuberant enthusiasts who don't want to pay taxes. This was paid for. We had it all paid. It was all paid for. And he just couldn't understand it. But why are we talking about him? Let's talk about Kamala Harris if we're going to talk. But if you have a pre-existing condition, beware of anything he has to say. He's really, what he does is he projects. Like he says, crazy Nancy, he's crazy. Crooked Hillary, he's crooked. Every adjective he uses is really about himself. And so that's what you have to understand. So when he's saying that people eat cats and dogs, I'm just wondering about him.
So you held a position more powerful than any other woman in American history. And you decided the time had come to step away from that position. And yet, and this is after you become the first speaker since Sam Rayburn to stay and fight for your majority back, and then you step away from the job. Could you talk a little bit about generational change in the House? In the House, yes.
Yeah, well, we're very proud of our generation. What you have to understand is since I became leader, whip leader, then speaker, the whole idea of diversity in the leadership changed. So it was viewed differently. It was like, well, we have wonderful talent. And when you have the job that I have, and it was a hard job, I mean, I probably didn't even sleep 4 hours a night. We're always policy, the politics, the people, the aspirations of the members, you know, so many things going on that you want the next person to do so much better because you have laid a foundation for them that you did not have. No offense to the people who went before me. It was just a different world. And so my excitement about it, and I was so excited about it, was that here they were ready to take over. Hakeem Jeffries to be the leader, Catherine Clark of Massachusetts. Well, Hakeem is from New York. Catherine Clark from Massachusetts, Pete Aguilar from California, Ted Lieu from California. They were outstanding, and there were many other outstanding members. So I knew that they could carry the ball, carry the torch, and the rest. So I was excited. My only hesitation was I had assembled, says she immodestly again, the greatest staff in the history of the Congress. Enormous talent on issues and process and the parliamentary procedure, how to get things done. But happily for me, many of them are spread among the new leadership, so we still have the benefit of their, for those who wanted to stay, we still have that. So that went away kind of fast. But we have to win this election. I'm telling you, the House of Representatives, I love it. If those of you, if and when you read the book, will know. I love the House. People always said, why didn't you run for something else? Why would I run for something else? I'm in the House of Representatives. And then, of course, to be the Speaker. But it is so exuberant. It's like a bandwagon every day, as opposed to a convoy down the hall that goes as slow as the slowest ship. But that's the way it is, and I make reference to that in the book too, so they know what I think. But the thing is you, the House can impeach.
Twice.
The House can impeach.
It can.
And we did on the basis of the law and the Constitution and the rest. They impeach if somebody does a stupid thing. you know, or they want to impeach, I don't know, Biden, what do they come up with something every day which has no basis. You can't have people be frivolous with the Constitution of the United States that our founders wrote to protect our rights, our country, our democracy. But there's a lot at risk in this election. Yeah.
So your decision to stay on the stage, yeah. Even though you have given up the gavel, I mean, this book is about power. Mm-hmm. And you still have a lot of power. I mean, we certainly have seen that over the last couple of months. This is my sneaky way of asking a Biden question. But so what do you think explains your own enduring influence and your own enduring power? Because it's not just connected to a title anymore.
Well, I don't have power. I mean, a speaker has awesome power. You pass laws, make committee assignments, recognize for speaking, all kinds of power. You don't, but so that power is different. Influence is a different thing. I think I have influence, but I don't really have power. So that's how I see it, yeah.
So our time is beginning to come to a close here, but we did ask for questions from some audience members. And I realize you are not here to fix the Republican Party, but one of our viewers named Gary Calhoun raises a question that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about as well. If Donald Trump does lose this election, where do you see the Republican Party, and especially those moderate Republicans that you were talking about? What happens going forward? Do you see any chance that there is still a core to the Republican Party that could sort of reject the MAGA movement, or are we just going to live with Trumpism?
Well, I'm probably the last person to ask about the future of the Republican Party. But as an observer, I would say what I said earlier, we need a strong Republican Party in our country. We need to recognize what was accomplished by the Republicans and the leadership that they have provided in the history of our country. It was founded by Abraham Lincoln. Well, it was founded by him. I don't know where he'd be now, but that's where it's found. But the I really do believe that there are, when I say this, I'm not talking about the Congress of the United States, many serious Republicans out there who, see, here's what the Republicans have told me, the outside Republicans, not in the Congress. Well, let me just give you some inventory. You know, we had a vote on Roe v. Wade, first time in the history of our country that freedom was pulled back. From the beginning of our country, this Constitution of the United States, bad in some respects with slavery and that kind of thing, but amendable, abolished slavery. We then black men had the right to vote, then women eventually had the right to vote, and Roe v. Wade, all these things that happened until the Dobbs decision. It was the first time in the history of our country when freedom was reduced. Freedom was reduced by this court. Freedom was reduced. So I know, so when we took up a vote to enshrine Roe v. Wade in the law of the land, of course we didn't get one Republican vote. Okay, but that's what they believe. Okay, so not one Republican vote. Then I said, I'm going to put on the floor, this was 2 years ago when we still had the majority, I'm going to put on the floor Kathy Manning of North Carolina. She had the bill that said women have a right to contraception. Have a right to contraception. 195 Republicans voted no. 8 voted yes. That's the Republican Party in the Congress of the United States. 8 voted yes to say women have a right to contraception. Now, when I was putting that on the floor, members were saying to me, why are you doing that? They're all going to vote for it, and they'll get well from their Roe v. Wade vote. I said, why am I here, okay? You're nice, I'm not, boom. 195 Republicans said, out of 203, that women do not have the right to contraception. So this is a very strange place. But what Republicans outside the Congress that I know, my friends, I do have Republican friends, and they said, if we can't beat them in the primary, you have to beat them in the general, and then we can go back to our competition on the role of government, you know, the traditional debate between Democrats and Republicans, rather than this divisive assault on our democracy that they are, that they exercise within a president of the United States inciting an insurrection on the Congress, on the Constitution, on the Capitol of the United States. Horrible. Coming after me for a bullet in the head, a noose for the vice president, and the president not sending the National Guard, even though he says, oh, I sent the... Get out of here. I mean, he really... It's really so sad because they were like, oh, we can't do that. It takes time. But in any case, this is a very dangerous situation. So let's hope that we can win the election responsibly, unifyingly, invitingly, to for people to work together. And a lot of those Republicans, if you take a poll, background checks, 80% for gun violence protection. There are lots of Republicans, and they're gun owners. They have background checks, so why shouldn't everybody else? When you take a poll about raising the minimum wage, overwhelmingly, so many votes, overwhelming in the public, but not in the Congress of the United States, and of course nothing demonstrates that more clearly than, of course, an ability to get background checks and ban assault weapons and that kind of thing, which has to be our, part of our first order of business when we win.
Well, Madam Speaker, this has been an absolute delight, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Again, thank you all. I want to thank you again. Thank you all very much. Bye-bye.